Okay, here we go. And this is another one of these, I think, absolutely fascinating portions. Matter of fact, when it comes to speculation, this may be the most speculated upon Torah portion in the entire book, in no small part because, of course, everybody remembers the famous prophecy repeated more than once, but Matthew 24, I'm pretty sure is where it is. It says, Yeshua speaking to those who were his taught ones, as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be in this time to come, in this end time, this time that he was prophesying about. And, of course, everybody wants to know, what the heck does that mean? And there is no shortage of speculation about all of that kind of stuff. We'll talk a little bit about that tonight, but at least I don't know that we'll answer the questions. But the questions themselves are kind of fascinating to think through. Let's, though, just begin in the portion and start with something that I think gets us off on the right track. That has to do with the naming of Noah and his birth. I'm actually going to start a couple verses prior to where this Torah portion starts. Technically, it starts in verse 9 of chapter 6 of Bereshit or Genesis. But at the end of chapter 5, we hear about his dad, Lamech, and how he was 182 years old when he had this boy, and he called his name Noah, saying, "This fellow, this same one, shall comfort us." And the root there in the Hebrew is Nacham. That's a Nun, a Chet, and a Mem. And it says, the root of the word Noah, in other words, might seem to be to comfort us. To comfort us. Well, actually, it looks like in the Hebrew, if you go look the word up, by the way, this is the first time that that in any form appears in Scripture, and it literally means to sigh. And if you think about it, like so many Hebrew words, this word has literally more than one meaning, and it kind of depends on what the vowel pointers are that are used in it. I mention it because not only is that the name, of course, of the character that's going to figure so prominently in this portion, but it also is the name of, well, the word, the root word that gets used just a few verses later, chapter 6, verse 6, where Yahuwah saw the wickedness of man. It was great. Be'eretz, in the earth, and every imagination of the thought of his heart was only evil continually, and he sighed. He nakamed. Ve'yinachem. It's rendered in the English here as, no, he repented. He was grieved. He regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. Same root word. Isn't it fascinating that the same word that his dad names the boy, saying he will grow up to comfort us, is the same word that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh uses? Same root. He sighed when he thought about men. And I think to a large extent, because people get upset. I've heard people say, you know, the creator of the universe repented. He grieved. No, he can't possibly do that. But I can at least imagine that he might look at what was going on down there and go, you know what? If he knew the end from the beginning and he knew this was going to happen, that still doesn't prevent him from taking a great big sigh when he sees just how it's playing out, even if we've been here and done this before, or at least seen it before. All right, well, that leads me to one of several themes that I want to introduce as we begin the actual portion here in verse 9. And it has to do with this idea of, well, we've only seen really two stories in the book so far. The story of creation, and now we're going to get the story of, let me say it this way, and we'll see how it rests with everybody, de-creation, destruction. He sighs, he grieves at the fact that he has made man, and he's going to literally sand it all down and start over again, it sounds like. So we're only six chapters in, and we've already got an entire cycle. Maybe more than one. I alluded last week to the fact that among the things that are speculated about in these first few chapters of Genesis, of Bereshit, because there's so much interesting information, so much tantalizing detail, and yet, if you actually step back and look at it, there's a whole heck of a lot that's left out, too. I saw one of the Midrashim today. Hey, you know, why are there no dinosaurs in the Torah? Well, wait a second. Who says they're not, for one? And the fact that we have all these animals brought on board, it doesn't say that they don't include dinosaurs. They might have been little teeny dinosaurs. They'll grow up to be bigger later. But I guess that's just another example of a lot of fascinating detail that we don't have. How many animals were there? Well, there were lots of them. We know that there were 7 pairs of every clean animal and 2 of the other kinds. But beyond that, we don't get a heck of a lot of detail. We get the list of a few of the names, but certainly it's not exhaustive. When it comes to creation, though, this is the theme I'm going to point out. I started the way I just did because of what's been called the gap theory, right? The world, the earth, was tohu vabohu, without form and void. What does that mean? Again, a tantalizing bit of detail. Was there something else that happened in between? How many years elapsed, right? We don't know the answer. Can't really say. I frequently make the point that I don't like to, and I'm not gonna, to the best of my ability, build doctrine on things that aren't stated explicitly in Scripture. Now, that's not, that doesn't mean that we're prohibited from speculating, you know, from sitting around letting iron sharpen iron and letting our imaginations wonder what might have happened and how many things that we see in Scripture that are playing out again today. Hey, if it's like the time of Noah now, as it was in the day of Noah, so will it be. Yeah, it's natural to want to speculate about such things. And certainly one of the speculations that I think fits in there is this idea of creation and then decreation, or destruction and then recreation. So I'll lay it out. We'll go through the story in just a second here, but most everybody already knows the story. If there's a single story in the Bible that everybody's heard, everybody's seen the little kiddie toys, right, with the little boats and all the little animals that can go in the boat. There is literally a flood, if you will, legend, at least, story in just about every culture on the earth. People will point to the Chinese language and note that the pictogram of boat and other things like that has a picture of a man in a boat with animals and stuff is part of the language and the lore. So we know that there's something very universal about this. There certainly is lots of evidence that supports the flood. You ever been to the Grand Canyon? I don't think that happened over billions and billions of years, personally. But again, the detail is tantalizing. All right, well, it goes like this. I give credit to Rabbi David Foreman. I'm not going to try to go through his entire exposition or those that have been laid out on his behalf, but essentially it goes like this. If you go through the story of Genesis and look at the creation, and you see that, you know, there was this ruach hovering over the face of the waters, and then you look at the story of Noah and the flood and of the time when the earth is flooded and his ruach is still hovering over the waters. Boy, the parallels are nothing short of amazing. So it does look like what we have here is a second creation story. Let me say that again. A second creation story. First time we had after, if there was a gap there, after Genesis 1, verses 2 and 3 and so forth, we've got Adam v'Chava, Adam and Eve, and then their direct descendant, a little while later, almost 2,000 years later, along comes Noah. And there was a great big sigh. And now let me lunge into the story, and we'll see how some of this begins to play out and what it looks like. It begins in verse 8 and 9 by saying, Noah found grace in the eyes of Yahuwah. I mentioned that one, too, simply because I like to point out, no, grace is not a New Testament thing. The word appears over and over in Scripture. And here's Noah, who had found grace a long time ago. It's not like it was something new. It was renewed, perhaps, just like we're going to see a renewal of the earth in this time of Noah, too. These, it begins, though, are the generations of Noah. Noah, in his generations, I wonder what that qualifier means, was a man, he was a zodic, he was wholehearted. Noah walked with El. Now, another theme that I'm going to throw in here, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time dwelling on, is one that you will hear lots and lots of speculation if you read the sages and the Midrash. Says Noah was a zaddik. He was a righteous man. Okay, well, then he was. On the other hand, why does the word in his generations appear in there? Rashi and many, many others have said, well, it's a qualifier. And what that must mean is that Noah was a good dude compared to the other folks who were scumbags. That's my way of putting it. But if you compare him to, say, the generation of Abraham, he wasn't fit to sand their shoes off. In other words, it was a relative thing. Well, can't prove that, but they make a pretty good case. You look and see how Abraham interceded for people like in Sodom and Gomorrah, and you don't see that with Noah. It's the Lord, Noah. I'm gonna make a flood, right? How long can you tread water? Everybody's heard the Bill Cosby routine probably too. And we don't see Noah saying, hey, you sure you want to do that? How about I make the ark a little bit bigger and bring along some more people? Basically, he just kind of goes with the flow. No pun intended. So a lot of the people who look back at the story conclude that Noah was a Tzaddik. He walked with God. Wonderful. But he certainly doesn't have quite the moral suasion to have brought anybody else along with him or, to walk in the shoes of a man like Abraham. All right, he had three sons. We know about this. And it says here the earth, Haaretz, was corrupt before Elohim, and it was filled with chamas, violence. And Elohim saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. And all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Other sages will point out, well, these words here have to do with idolatry and with lewdness and other things. And some of the other things are kind of interesting. I may take a quick pause here, too, because I want to ask some questions as we go through this. I have already suggested that the instruction of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, while it was not yet written down, as Moses later wrote it down, we do know that Noah obviously understood what clean and unclean animals were, even though he hadn't been eating any prior to this point, evidently. Wonder what else people would have known. And furthermore, why is it that Elohim decides that these people are fully corrupt and basically scumbags and needed dying? In other words, why do we have a flood anyway? Because people will point to Torah and then they'll point to some of the writings of Paul, for example, and say, where there is no law, there is no sin imputed. So for crying out loud, how does God get off whacking all the people on the earth with a great big flood? If there was no written law, and if the law is done away with now, it's the same deal, right? As it was in the days of Noah. So, you know what? I'm not buying any of that. I think basically there were plenty of reasons to believe from Scripture that there was some instruction, even if it wasn't necessarily written down, and that the earth was, in fact, because it says so here, corrupt. All flesh had corrupted their way. And Elohim then says to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me. The earth is filled with chamas, and behold, I am fixing to destroy the whole thing. Now, I mentioned this concept of a creation, and then a sanding down, or a time of destruction, and then the story of Noah. And we know how it ends too, right? Elohim says to Noah after he comes out of the ark, he says, I'm not going to do this anymore. Not going to destroy the world with water for sure. And there will not be an end to harvest time and seed time and so forth. He makes several promises, as you've probably heard it referred to as the Noahide covenant. So again, you have to ask the question. This is really an interesting observation. Was God just full of it? Was he wrong? Did he decide that he made yet another mistake? Oops, I didn't mean to do that. I don't think I'm ever do that again. Or is there something else going on here that maybe we need to take a deeper look at? And I do like this observation. I'm not going to tell you that I think it's gospel, but I think it certainly merits some discussion. And it goes back to this idea of these themes of a creation and then a destruction and kind of a re-creation. Oh, hey, you know what? As it was in the time of Noah, so will it be at the end. If there is indeed yet another new heaven and a new earth, another re-creation coming, third time's a charm. Now, third time has something to do with the number that the Creator has used over and over again. Well, anyway, maybe there's a pattern there. And if that's true, it kind of behooves us to look into the pattern a little bit more, right? Why the flood? What's going on? Well, let's go through it. Let's take our time and go through it a little bit more slowly. The earth is filled with violence, and behold, I'm going to destroy them all. So build an ark. Make it out of gopher wood. He gives the dimensions here, 300 cubits by 50 cubits wide by 30 cubits high. That's essentially about 450 feet long and, cubits on the order of a foot and a half or so. finish it. It's going to be three stories. When I bring the flood waters on the earth to destroy all flesh, everything upon which there is the Ruach Chaim, the breath of life under heaven, all the animals. But I'm going to reestablish my covenant with you. When you come into the ark with your sons' wives, and you bring two of every living thing, male and female, and all the fowls and all the creeping things, to keep them alive. And all the food that is eaten, too. All right, so he is saving some things out of the earth, but sanding off the vast majority of things. It's not, in other words, a complete reset to zero. There's a lot of creation that is being saved here. Certainly the things that swim in the sea, those aren't going to be sanded down by what's going on here. It has something to do with this concept of all flesh is corrupt and filled with violence and so forth. That's what he's getting rid of. Does seem to be that he knows that they ought to have known what's going on here. There are even some suggestions it's not just idolatry and lewdness and so forth, but that there is a different mode of punishment in this first creation. Indeed, that's essentially Rabbi David Foreman's main theme, is that this first creation and the one that is going to follow the flood, you've heard the term antediluvian, the pre-flood world and the post-flood world, that these are, in fact, very different creations. And on its face, that doesn't seem at all surprising, right? There was this canopy above the earth at one time. A lot of this water, the water came from somewhere. It came up out of the fountains of the deep, and then it goes somewhere. So something about the earth is very, very different. We know, by the way, too, that there's a precedent for this, that Adam and Eve were immortal at one point, and then they're not anymore. Their bodies evidently did change. We know that there are some other things that changed too, like prior to the time of the flood, men didn't evidently eat animals, and some animals didn't eat other animals, but that seems to change too. So indeed, there seems to be more than a little bit of evidence in Scripture that something about the creation, the re-creation that follows the flood is indeed very different than what was there before. And it's almost like, now I hate the term dispensation, I'm not going to use that, because I don't believe that at all, but I do tend to suggest that the Creator is perfectly capable of tweaking things, and we see that in a number of places. That certainly looks like what happened here. And David Foreman's suggestion is that prior to this time, the Creator dealt directly with sin, and that after this time, some of those things changed a little bit too. Certainly as there got to be more people upon the earth, well, it looks like a lot of things would have changed if for no other reason than that. Let's go back to the story. Pick it up at about verse 22 here. So Noah did all that he had been commanded to do. So did he. We see the same thing is said of other men of Yah, like Noah, Moshe. And that's a good thing. May it be said of us. He was commanded to do things, and he did them. And then he says to Noah, come on in, you and all your house. I have seen that you guys are tzaddik, righteous before me. Here's where we note that we're going to get seven of all these clean beasts. And I do believe that they're pairs, because it does say seven. It says shava, shava, seven and seven. So take the clean beasts, seven and seven, like maybe that means seven males and seven females, seven pairs, each with his mate. Well, there you go. And of the beasts that are not clean, two and two, each with his mate. Fowls of the air, seven and seven, male and female, to keep their seed alive upon the earth 7 days. Hence, I'm going to start to cause it to rain. It's going to rain for 40 days and 40 night, and all of these living things on the surface of the earth are going to get blotted out. So it says again, Yahuwah commanded him, Noah did. And then we're told he was 600 years old when the flood waters came upon the earth. So Noah went into the ark with his wives and with his sons and with their wives because of the waters of the flood. Now, numbers are always interesting, too. Let's just point this out. We got Noah and three sons, and a wife for each of them is eight people, eight folks. Have you ever heard some of people like Bollinger talking about numbers in Scripture? We've got 7 days and a week. What's the eighth day? It's the time when things start up again. What are we talking about here? Eight people. New beginnings to restart the creation afterwards of the people. It came to pass after 7 days, the waters of the flood were upon the earth, 600th year, second month, 17th day of the month. The fountains of the deep were broken up, the windows of heaven were opened, and the deluge came down for 40 days and 40 nights. And Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, sons of Noah, and all their wives, who were never, by the way, went into the ark, and all the beasts too. And they went in, all of whom had in them the breath of life, male and female. And then, it says, Yahuwah shut them in. He literally sealed them up. I like this way of thinking about it. He covered them. He sealed them up. He sealed the ark, and they were protected in there. Oh, I see a comment on the screen. You know, and I didn't mention this. Well, we'll come back to it. We'll get to it. What else was going on the earth? Why is there so much wickedness? And what happens before and after this time? And there is a reference to the Nephilim, right? The people that took wives of all that they chose, took women of all that they chose. Lots and lots of speculation. I guess we won't go there. Was one of these Nephilim hanging on the outside of the ark? Certainly that's one of the things you'll hear in the oral tradition. So the waters rose up, the ark floated on the waters, they prevailed. All of the high mountains under the entire of heaven were covered. 15 cubits upwards did the waters prevail over the tops of the highest mountains. And all flesh perished, both fowl, cattle, and beasts, and everything that swarms, and every man, all of those in whose nostrils was found the breath of the spirit, of the ruach, of life, anything on the dry land died. And Yahuwah blotted out every living substance from upon the face of the ground. Only Noah was left and those that were with him in the ark. And these waters prevailed upon the earth for 150 days. Then in verse 8, we see the first use of this word remembered. Yitzchor. And Elohim remembered Noah and every living thing, all the stuff that was within him in the ark. And he made a wind pass over the earth. There's that word again. Let me make sure it's ruach in this case. And the waters assuaged. Fountains of the deep were stopped. The rain was restrained. The waters returned from off the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, they began to decrease. And eventually the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, in the mountains of Ararat. And there's lots of speculation about where that is. Some of you probably run into the various archaeologists that are fairly well known in the Mexican Christian communities that may or may not have identified the resting place of the ark. Fascinating stuff. And I guess one of these days we'll probably have more confirmation on that score. I think it's really kind of interesting, of course, that even though the flood, as I've already mentioned, is ubiquitous, it is pervasive among the cultures of the earth, when it comes to what Big Brother America and the Smithsonian Institution and Hollywood wants you to hear about, they may make movies about it. They're going to twist the heck out of the story. But for the most part, the scientific community doesn't seem to want to admit that there is all kinds of evidence, not only of floods, but of giants and of all kinds of things, including maybe dinosaurs that that were running around at a similar time as men. No, that just... You know, that distorts the whole billions and billions of years narrative, and we're not going to talk about that. Anyway, at the end of 40 days, Noah opens a window. He sent forth a raven, basically, there's not much more said about the raven. Then eventually he sent forth a dove to see if the waters were abated. But the dove, the first time out, didn't find any place to light. So she returned. And then he took her back in, and he stayed there another 7 days, and then again sent the dove out of the ark. This time the dove came in at evening, and now she has a freshly picked olive leaf. So Noah began to suspect that there were trees, vegetation again growing on the face of the earth. So he stayed another 7 days, sent the dove out, but this time she didn't come back. So it came to pass, says verse 13, in the 601st year and the first month and first day of Noah's life, the waters were dried up. He removed the covering and looked, and there you go. There's dry ground. And in the second month, 27th day of the month, the earth was dry. Guess it wasn't even muddy to the point where they would, get stuck if they came out. So Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh this time spoke to Noah, and he said, "Go forth, you and your wife and your sons and your sons' wives. Bring all of the living things with you, fish and flesh, all flesh, fowl and cattle and every creeping thing, that they may now be out again on the earth and swarm and be fruitful and multiply." Hey, there's another one of those parallels. We've heard that before, haven't we? Just the previous Torah portion, the previous chapter about the first creation. Be fruitful, multiply. Here it is again. So Noah went forth. Every beast, every creeping thing, every fowl, they went out of the ark. And then Noah decided to build an altar to Yahuwah. He took of those clean animals, the fowl and the beast, and he made and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Now here comes the part that is one of the things that I alluded to right up front. And Yahuwah smelled that sweet savor, and he said in his heart, "I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake." Remember, that's what he did with Adam because of the rebellion of the first man. "For the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth." Huh. Sounds like he has basically come to terms with the fact that he's given these people a choice and the imaginations of their heart are evil from their youth. "Neither, though, will I again smite any more everything living as I have done." And then he says this, "While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, they shall not cease." And then Yahuwah blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, another repetitious command, "Be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth." And there's going to be a lot of things that are different at this point. Here seems to be one of them. "Fear of you and dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and all the birds in the sky, and all the things that are teeming along on the ground. And the fishes of the sea too. Into your hand, though, they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. As the green herb have I given you all." Now that is a problematic verse. Oh, is here where he's saying, go out and eat yourself some pigs? It does not seem to be the case. The question is, what is being described as food for what animals, right? "Flesh with the life, though, the blood, you are not to eat. And surely the blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast I'll require it, at the hand of man, even in the hand of every man's brother, will I require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by him..." Well, "by man shall his blood also be shed." Because remember, man was made in the image of Elohim. So you guys, be fruitful, multiply, swarm on the earth. And then Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and said, "As for me, I am now going to establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you." Now this one is interesting to me, and it's going to be another one of the themes that I think is going to appear in here. And it's also a theme, since I laid out this idea of, as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be. Here's one to just kind of write on the wall and think about. All right, I'm going to establish my covenant with you. With every living thing, fish, fowl, cattle, beast of the earth, everything that goes out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Here you go. "Neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of the flood, nor will there ever be a flood to destroy the earth." And then he said, "All right, here is this token of this covenant that I am going to cut between me and you and every living thing that is with you for perpetual generations. I have set my bow in the cloud. It shall be a token of a covenant between me and the earth. It'll come to pass when I bring clouds over the earth and that bow is seen in the clouds that I will remember my covenant between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the waters will no more become a flood to destroy all flesh." That bow is going to be in the cloud. I will look upon it, and I will remember my everlasting covenant between Elohim and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth. I already see people on the screen are thinking what it is that I'm thinking. If there is another theme in here, it has to do with the theme of things that Elohim creates. And men, because their imaginations of their heart are only wicked from their birth, pervert. We're going to see at least one more example in here. But certainly there's no question that be fruitful and multiply does not apply to a man lying with a man as with a woman, to something that later on we are told, if they didn't know it already, we certainly have it written down now, is abomination. And so what has happened? Some very, very wicked men have literally perverted the singular symbol of the covenant that was made between Elohim and men, and indeed all of the living things on the earth, that he was not going to destroy them for that wickedness anymore. And what are they doing? I guess they're rubbing his face in it. I guess we'll come back to that. Sons of Noah went out from the ark. We've heard their names before. Shem, Ham, Japheth. Ham, it tells us, is the father of Canaan. Now we know who the Canaanites are. We know that the line of Ham is not a particularly blessed line. These are the three sons of Noah. They spread over the whole earth. Noah, the husbandman, began. Ha Adama. Noah, the husbandman. Ha Adama. Anybody recognize the root in there? The husbandman. Ish is the other word here. That's the man. And then ha Adama. So we got a repetition of the word ish, or man, or husband, and also husbandman. What was it Adam was sent to do? He was put in the garden. Noah begins to be a planter. He plants a vineyard. Now, he does something else here that does not seem to ingratiate him to subsequent generations. Now, this one is another a bit problematic. Lots and lots of speculation here. I'm not going to engage in the speculation as to what all of this really means. I'm sure probably by now most of you have heard half a dozen of them. He drank the wine. He got drunk. Okay, not so good. He was naked. He was uncovered within his tent. Now, what does uncovered mean? Certainly the word naked is clear, and I don't doubt that there's a physical understanding as well. But it has also been suggested, and this is about as far I'll go down the line of speculation, that Noah's uncoveredness was also apparent in more ways than one. In other words, maybe after the flood is over and people are, the few people that are left, Noah and his three sons and their wives, thinking about the destruction that has been wrought upon the earth, are kind of wondering, wow, you know, could Dad have done more? Could we have done more? I think you'd have to at least wonder why you're the only ones that have survived. Maybe even if they understood the amount of wickedness here that was cleansed, that was sanded down, still, it at least seems clear to me that people are going to have some recriminative self-incriminating kind of thoughts, right? Doesn't that make sense? So all I'm suggesting is just maybe Noah's nakedness was revealed in more ways than one. That's at least what some of the sages have tried to point out. Well, Ham, father of Canaan, why does it keep telling us that, right? As if we didn't already know that the Canaanites were idolaters and these people too are going to get sanded out of the land many, many generations later. But Ham saw the nakedness of his father, told his two brothers outside about it. Now, they didn't seem to react the same way that Ham did. It has been speculated, well, what happened? Did Ham commit some sodomy with his father? Did he do any number of really nasty things? Well, we don't have the detail on that. Like I said, there's no shortage of speculation. But whatever he did, it was certainly something very, very negative. So Shem and Japheth took a garment. They laid it on their shoulders. They went in backwards, covered the nakedness of their fathers. Says their faces were backward, so they didn't see his nakedness. Is it also implying? I don't know, but is it also implying that basically they didn't see the other kind of spiritual nakedness either? Noah woke up. He slept it off. He knew what his youngest son had done to him, whatever it was, and he said, "Cursed be Ham." That would make sense, doesn't it? But that's not what he says, right? He doesn't curse Ham. He curses Canaan, Ham's son, the one that we've been told twice about here. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. And he said, Blessed be Yahuwah, Elohim of Shem, and let Canaan be their servant. And let Elohim enlarge Japheth, that he will dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be their servant. So there's an interesting set of instructions and curses that are laid out here. And they skip the generation of Ham. There's a lot of reasons why that might be, too. And I'm just going to leave that, you know, sit there as well. By the way, a lot of these things, not necessarily all of them, I'm going to probably go into a little bit more depth in tomorrow. As you know, one of the things I like to do is try to just go through the Torah portion on Erev Shabbat and then come back and maybe examine some of the other interesting little rabbit trails and so forth in more detail on Shabbat. So some of these at least will be things we may touch on again. Noah lived after the flood 350 years. That's quite a while. How many generations and generations of generations are we going to see in 350 years? That would take Noah literally a long ways towards the time of Abraham. Matter of fact, it's been suggested that Shem clearly lived long enough to have even known Abraham. One of the speculations in the Midrash is that, you know, when that Abraham and maybe even Yaakov at some point went and attended Shem U, Shem's university, the school of Torah that Shem may have had. Again, those are things that cannot be proven. The oral tradition will say so. But the point that I'm trying to make here is Noah lived for a long, long time, 350 years after the flood. And if you think about that and what we're going to see next, you have to ask one more question. And it does kind of tie back in with this theme of father's nakedness. And Noah was a tzaddik, was a righteous man. But what is Scripture going to tell us next? Well, it's going to tell us in chapter 10 about the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. They had sons. Tells us who they were. I'm not going to read all of this because it's pretty detailed. As a matter of fact, it really does take a chart for most of us to kind of figure out who begat who and which lines went where. Kind of fascinating, and you'll see a lot of these names. Not only are the names meaningful, but they're appearing again over and over again in Scripture. Sons of Japheth, Gomer, Magog, we know that name, Madai, Yavan, Tubal, Meshach, Tiras. And then it gives the sons of Gomer and Yavan and so forth. And then we get to Ham. Well, he had a son named Cush. Mitzrayim, where do we know that name? Oh, that's Egypt, right? Mitzrayim. And Put, and then, of course, the aforementioned Canaan. They're named as if Canaan is the last one there. Then we get the sons of Cush. And, oh, Cush has a famous son. He begot Nimrod, who started to be a mighty one in the earth. We're no doubt going to come back to him as well. Canaan gives the line of his sons, his firstborn, Zidon, and so forth. Obviously, these people are going to be fruitful and multiply. So we got sons begetting sons and spreading all over the place. We have the sons of Ham, Canaan, the one that is going to be cursed, and his brother, Cush, who begets Nimrod, who becomes, literally, the, I hate to put it this way, the George Washington of Babylon, the founding idol for literally the entire mystery Babylon religion. Whole lots of idolatry surrounds this guy Nimrod. In other words, there's some pretty nasty stuff happening here. We know what's going to happen with Nimrod. We'll get to that story in just a second. Lots of genealogy first. Tells us where these people go. They settle in different places, sons of Shem, after their families and tongues and their lands and their nations. Well, it says at the end of chapter 10, here are all the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations, in their nations. And by the way, if you add them all up, evidently, the sages say there's 70 of them, divided in the earth after the flood. And then chapter 11 begins, and I'm going to go back to the theme I laid out a second ago and left hanging there. The whole earth, it says, Ha'aretz, Kol Ha'aretz, was of one language and one speech. Paleo-Hebrew, some ancient predecessor to the language, perhaps. I tend to think that that may have been what the case was. They came as they journeyed east, found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they began to do something that is also another very famous story in Scripture. Now, here's where I pause and ask this question. They're going to do something that's evidently not good. Noah lived 350 years after the flood, right? Where's Noah? Where's the, literally, where is the patriarch, de tutte patriarchs, when these folks are starting to do these bad things? And it has been suggested, again, that maybe what Noah is doing is the same thing that Noah was doing before, which is kind of letting the world go on independently, without interceding, without offering counsel or wisdom, or without saying, for crying out loud, guys, can't you see what's happening again has happened before? We don't get any of that. And I find that, interesting, if not downright damning. So what do they do while Noah is literally not in the picture? What they say is, let's go build us a city and a tower with its top in heaven, and let us make a name, Shem. Same name as oldest of Noah's sons. Let us make a Shem, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Now, what's wrong with that? You do have to kind of do a little bit of reading and speculating in order to see what the problem is here. There is a suggestion that I've heard made now for a number of years, and the more I read this portion, the more I think about it, the more I tend to think, yeah, it resonates with me a little bit more every time. And it begins to kind of, especially nowadays, as we ask this question, as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be. What are we talking about here? Well, let's read the story, see if it begins to take shape, and then I won't have to lay it out. I'll let you think about it on your own and get there. Let's build a city with a tower, and its top will be in heaven, so we can make a name. Evidently, this is about a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. There are others that suggest maybe this has to do with lest God send us all off again. It doesn't literally come right out and say that, although I can't argue that it could be in the back of people's minds. Maybe they heard about it from, Uncle Shem or Granddad Ham or whatever the case may be. It does tell us in verse 5, Yahuwah came down, he saw the city and the tower, which the children of men were building. And he said, behold, here are a people that are echad. They're working in unity. They all have one language. And here seems to be the crux of the matter. And this is what they began to do. They could have done all kinds of things, but here is the problem. Whatever the problem is, this is what they have decided to do. Now nothing will be withholden from them, he said, which they purpose to do. So let us, the royal we, go down, confound their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech. And that word confound there literally is the same word that's used for mingled, when things are mingled with oil and so forth. So confound is an interesting word even in the English. I will tell you that the word Torah and the Greek word nomos, for example, law, is confusing to people because it's confounded. See, the word nomos, that Greek word, is used for all kinds of law. And all kinds of other things, too. In other words, the word is confounded because the word is too broad. It's confusing. And the English word law is just plain wrong. It's not a reliable translation of the word Torah. And you know why. Torah is instruction, and it includes law. And then nomos is law, but nomos includes all kinds of other law. There's men's law, and there's the traditions of the elders. All that kind of stuff gets called nomos. The word is confounded. So it's interesting here. What they're going to find is their languages literally get mingled, confounded, to the point that they don't understand one another. And I guess I will suggest to you that goes on today, to the point where we now have tens of thousands of different denominations that don't understand one another and indeed don't read the original language, because most of them are convinced it was done away with anyway. And, of course, the Babylonian religion has been ensconced in the church for a long time. It is really interesting, in other words, how much of this story, well, as it was in the days of Noah, before or after the flood, so will it be, still is. So Yahuwah scattered them from there, all over the place. And they left off building the city, and they called the name of this place Babel. Babylon, we get the English modern word Babel. They were just babbling, like chickens in a chicken coop. They were babbling. Because Yahuwah confounded the language, and there did he scatter them abroad upon all of the places of the earth. Here are the generations of Shem. Shem was 200 years old when he begot his son Arpachshad, 2 years after the flood. He lived 500 years later. And then we get a little bit more about the line of Shem. And on down, Arpachshad begot Shelah, who had sons and daughters. Shelah lived for 30 years. He begot Eber, and he had sons and daughters. And then there was a fellow named Peleg, who was born of Eber. He lived 30 years. Oh, in his time, remember, the earth was divided. He begot Reu, who begot Serug, and he begot sons and daughters. Then we have Nahor, and then finally Nahor has a son. You may have heard this name before, Terah. At age 119, Terah has sons and daughters. He lives 70 years, and here we are. He finally begets a fellow that I know we remember his name. Terah was the father of Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Tells us what happened to Haran. He died of his father in the land of his nativity, Ur of the Chaldees. And Abraham and Nahor took wives. We know the name of Abram's wife, Sarai. And we're going to come back to all of this in the next portion, because we're going to begin to follow Abraham in some detail. As a matter of fact, we're probably going to hear more about Abraham than we have, well, for sure, any of these other people up until now. If we go through the math, and I would encourage people to and I've done this, but it's been a while. I probably ought to pull it out again. I've got some nice books that have pretty colored pictures that are better than the ones that I drew. But laying out all of these genealogies and who begot whom and when and how old they were, and literally you can calculate the time frames here and see that Shem was still alive when Abraham is born and all of the things that follow. But we'll get to that in the future. What I want to do as we start to wrap it up is try to address a couple of questions that I've already laid out, and I don't know that I can give you an answer for, but at least maybe some of the pieces will start to fit into place. Let me say this. If there are questions on the screen that I haven't addressed yet, or questions that aren't on the screen that you'd like addressed, go ahead and put them up, and we'll try to cover some of those. Obviously, we can't run down all the rabbit trails. But one of the other things that ties together these themes of creation and destruction, and as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be, and what is it that caused Elohim to confound their language? What was it that men were doing? It goes something like this. There was a key to the construction of the city and the tower. And it had to do with a technological innovation. Now, this, again, is extra-biblical. However, it is consistent with things we're going to read later. So I'm going to throw this out there and tell you, don't build doctrine on it, but I do think the speculation is valuable and interesting, and it certainly at least helps to kind of flesh out as it was in the days of Noah for us. So, again, it has to do with technology and the fact that people are starting to do something hundreds of years now, after the flood, a number of generations, as we've seen, that just may have been a part of the problem. And the word is bricks. We know later that when people are going to build an altar for Yahuwah, they're told a tool is not to come upon these things. In other words, the stones that you're going to use to build my altar are my stones, my building blocks. They're irregular. They're not all uniform. They're not all cast in a mold. And you know what? I like that particular understanding because it describes us. We're not all uniform. We're stones. We're building blocks. You'll hear all the metaphors that are used in, even in the church nowadays about we're the stones and build the church out of us and all that kind of stuff. Okay, I don't like some of that terminology because I think it carries a lot of other bad baggage. But I do like the idea that it's clear we're individual. and that when it comes to building his altars and the things that he describes, there's a reason why no tool is to come upon them. And it would seem to me, even if we don't know what the reason is, that it may have something to do with what was going on here building the Tower of Babel. And again, it has been suggested. You notice I'm not going to say that thus spoke Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. I'm trying to be real careful to avoid that. So I'll just ask, does this make sense? Think about it. Think about the implications, and then pray about it and see if other things in Scripture don't start to fall into place as a result. But the idea of a brick as a technology is that it's a nice uniform thing. Every brick is the same as every other brick. Got lots and lots and lots of bricks. Well, what about bricks then is kind of cool, at least as far as men are concerned. Answer, we can mass produce them. We can get assembly lines out there of people making brick after brick after brick after brick and laying line upon line of bricks and bricks and bricks and building this tower up to who knows where, up to heaven. In other words, and maybe this is a term that you've heard me use before already, we can take some technology and use it for our purposes. What was it Scripture said? To make a name for ourselves, circumvent what it is that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is doing. If we can make technology, you know, and bricks and build edifices to ourselves, can't we do the same thing with people? Can't we just treat people as if, oh, I know, I got a great name for them. Let's call them human resources. How's that for turning a person into a commodity? One brick is like another brick. I remember when I was an engineer at IBM and other places. Well, we got headcount. Right? Got to have a department, and we're going to have 27 headcount for next year for this project. What's a headcount? Well, you know, one head, same as another head. Yeah, later we'll talk about what we need, but basically all of the budgeting is in terms of headcount. Bricks, don't you know? Human resources. What's the nice thing about a human resource? Well, you depreciate it down to zero, you write it off, you throw it away. We'll get us some more. What I'm suggesting here is that there is a common thread, to my mind, that runs through these themes and the creation. And that is that the things that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh did were unique. And that they were about making his name. And ultimately, it looks like the reason that the creation keeps getting sanded down happened at the time of Adam, and it seems to be happening again, as it was in the time of Noah, so will it be. There are things that he has put in his creation that are there for our blessing and our good, and we tend to think we can make them better than he did for whatever reason. I mentioned one already, the rainbow. Oh, it's up there, it's a sign, but we're going to take the rainbow, we're going to make it better. We're going to make the rainbow a symbol of something that he calls abomination. We're going to twist it, pervert it, turn it into something different. He made rocks, we made bricks. Building blocks. We can build all kinds of amazing things. And that, I guess, brings me to the last element. I'm just going to throw this out there as a question. If DNA is the building block of life, can we improve that? I've seen several stories in the last few weeks about how scientists are actually saying we can create DNA with more connectivity, basically, additional coding sequences. DNA basically is a four-part structure in this deoxyribonucleic acid, this double helix, this twisted strand. And mankind is basically saying, we can do better. We can do things that the God of the Bible never even thought about. We can twist and turn his creation into something downright abominable. And of course, there you go. Probably by now you've heard speculation, as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be, just may apply to men having turned and twisted creation into other kinds of various things. Thence the reference to Nephilim and the daughters of men and what was done with them. Was it a human-angel hybrid that's being talked about, or even DNA manipulation? The details are kind of tantalizingly sparse. But if the theme at least resonates with you, I'll just leave it at that. I can't help but thinking that may be one of the reasons why the Creator sighs. And he sees that the wickedness of men's hearts is there. And whatever it is that he has created for good and for blessing, somehow or other, we keep managing to take it and twist it, make a name for ourselves, and say we can do better. and the end thereof seems to be destruction more often than not. So if we can do it with bricks and a tower to the heavens, hey, maybe we can do it with the very building block, the tower that creates life itself. So we'll leave it at that.